Recently, I received a letter inquiring about a certain topic from, and it was by a professor at a university. He was teaching religion courses, and Buddhism was one of his aspects that he was doing, and he wanted to know certain terms that we used in terms of this, because they were not familiar to him. And in the course of answering the letter, I had to do some digging around, and since I had all this stuff dug up, and I was asked to give a talk, I thought, yeah, I can dump it all on you. the results of what I had done. And it also might even be helpful to you as well, which I trust it will. It is a subject that I'm sure has been brought up many, many times here, but there's always the possibility that bringing it in a slightly different angle may open up something for some of you here. Others, you may say, oh, I've heard this 1,000 times. Now it's 1,001. But whatever, I will offer the material to you. The person was concerned with the idea of renunciation of the world and what this meant and how Buddhists translated the term and what was the original term for it and so forth. I don't know why you want to know the original, but anyway, I dug up the Sanskrit terms. One of the aspects of renunciation of the world was that he had seen a film or TV program, I guess it's called In Search Of, and which dealt, I don't know what it dealt, he didn't say what it dealt with, but it had a very poignant presentation of an elderly gentleman who was dying and was giving away his various things that he had, including his glasses and his teeth, as well as his library, his prized library, because he had been an Oxford scholar in his younger days and so forth, as he prepared for death. And this was what the person that he had seen, it was presented as he had seen the illusory nature of all these things and was therefore renouncing the world and giving these up. And it was apparently quite affected the professor who was asking the question. Well, I immediately had some problems with this, because popular presentations of Buddhism do not necessarily reflect Buddhism. They reflect popular ideas about it, and these may not necessarily be those that, at least I, as a Buddhist, would understand these things. First of all, the term renunciation of the world has a very definite meaning in Indian culture, not Buddhist Indian culture, but Indian culture in general. And it goes back to a practice in which a householder, as he reaches a certain age in his life, distributes his goods, says farewell to his wife and his family, and goes off into the forest to spend his last days or years spiritually meditating and contemplating on various spiritual matters. It's a phase of the life of a householder on the thing. Now, how that was actually carried out, there's undoubtedly people who did this, and then there are stories of people who did this, and of course their families and servants came along to take care of them, you know, and you've got this whole mass of people in the forest taking care of people who have gone off to be alone to men. You know, you get this very strange, so you got these two things going at once, but the whole idea there is renunciation of the world is giving everything up I've got and going off and dying. And that is a tendency to think of renunciation of the world. If it isn't quite dying, it's even worse, it's giving it all up and living. So, the thing is, what is the renunciation of the world from the Buddhist viewpoint? Well, first of all, renunciation is associated specifically with the Buddha's leaving his home behind. Not abandoning his family. This is usually presented sometimes as he abandoned his wife and his child and went off to search for a spiritual goal, to which many people respond, what's this giving up the wife and kid? You know, doesn't he have any sense of responsibility? You know, he has obligations, and so forth. Well, first of all, one has to recognize this was India 2,500 years ago. And he was of a class which was an extremely wealthy and powerful class. And the relationship between husband and wife is not that which we have today. but is one that is quite, it was quite formal. Marriages were arranged, and they were arranged for one purpose, and that is for there to be children so that the family could continue. And that's what the purpose of marriage was. It had nothing to do with love, affection, a helpmate, or friendship, or anything else. It had simply to do with that. So the most beautiful and comely woman had a better chance at getting a comfortable living because she could be married off to a prince. So if you're going to have a baby girl, it better be a beautiful one. And this is something that comes into much of Indian culture at that time. He wasn't abandoning his child because the child was going to be taken care of by servants and raised by servants anyway. It is not the fatherly relationship we see. So the idea of the abandonment there would not have bothered people of that time, as it would might well when we stick past history into present values. But the renunciation that he was going to do was not his abandoning the world, not his turning his back on the world, but rather his re-evaluation of what the world was up to. And in evaluating that, it was looking at the cultural values of his time and sitting with everything that everybody had said, well, this is the way you live your life, this is what you do, this is good and that is bad, and this is right and that is wrong, and that whole thing, that's the world of our values and the world of our attitudes and what we think is important in life and what we don't think is important in life, and with things like fame and gain. You want to be famous, you want to get gain, and if you don't, well, then you're a failure or whatever, and all of these things coming in, or you belong to a certain class and you have that your duty, if you want to live, is to stick to what that class is. You can't move, you can't do anything. That's your life. And if you're a potter, you're tied to your wheel. You're nailed to your wheel. And that's what you are for the rest of your life, and you're nothing else but a potter, or whatever it is. So it was a time to say, put all that behind me, and to see what's really there, without adding all of this other world of values. And he, of course, came from a very wealthy family, one in which they could afford all the luxuries of the time, and he was, of course, kept from knowing that there was really anything outside of that world. He was protected. Now, we can find that in our society today, of children that are raised in a family that is very wealthy and can afford to send them to what are called the best schools, to have them associate with the best people and do this with, and live in the best houses and have the best food and wear the best clothes and so forth. All as if that was all there was, and some people are brought up in that world. They don't know anything else. I mean, nothing else really exists for them because they never come into contact with anything but that. And that's what the Buddha was faced with. And suddenly he realizes there's something else besides this. And he, of course, sees the four people, and they shock him because he can't make them fit into this world of beautiful people that he sees around him. And he's going to have to try to integrate that. What's going on here? What is happening in this? And why are these people being ignored? This is what we come to. What is happening here? Why am I kept from this? I need to know. I need to know why I have been protected. And therefore he renounces the world. He doesn't denounce it. He doesn't condemn it. He doesn't say, you people are all wrong. You people are all this and that. I've got to know this. I've got to understand this. And therefore, for him, the only way to do it was to go off and say, I will just have to get out of here, because everything around me is telling me it's this way, that the world is this way, the society is this way, and I'm knowing it's not, it isn't this way. What am I going to do? So he goes out, and that is the renunciation of the world. Now, it's the leaving home behind in all the sense of what home is and all the values of what are considered there. Not denying, not saying they're wrong, but you got to look at them. You've got to look at the values that are going on. All right, so he leaves. And we have now another term, renunciation of the world, which is associated with people who leave home to become monks. Again, that's like Shakyamuni's thing of something has happened to make them feel, I've got to just sit, go into a monastery, and find out what is going on in the world. It's not a running away from the world. It's trying to find out what is the world and what is going on with it. And so that person needs to go to the degree of renouncing the world, of actually giving up everything to become a monk. Say, I'll give up whatever I have. I'll give up whatever I think I own. And just start from scratch and see if I can find out the answer to that in terms of my own life, in terms of my own experience, in terms of my own background. Find out what it is. And I'm willing to give up, quote, everything to find it out. I really want to know it that bad. Now, this is very nice and everything, but what about lay people? Because lay people are not leaving home. But as the Buddha said, at all times, it's over and over again, he says this in the scriptures, there are four classes of Buddhists. Male monks, female monks, male lay, female lay. Four classes, four groups. They're not one, and that isn't in order of importance. They're just the four groups. And you'll fall into one of the four if you are a Buddhist. So what does renunciation mean? For the person who is not doing that kind of renouncing to be a monk, what is renunciation then? And one says, oh, well, you can't renounce. Or, well, you just have to live in abject poverty, then you'll know. No. The clue is right in what the Buddha was doing. The clue is, it is a time for you to look at your values, of what you consider important and don't consider important. That's the beginning of your renunciation as a layperson. It was the beginning of mine many, many years ago, before I ever got to be a monk. There was something going on there of needing to know and wondering. And feeding that wonder, feeding that question, and allowing it to develop and allowing it to grow. Ultimately, I got the fortune, good fortune, to be able to be a monk. But it took me an awful long time to be able to get here. And I had to wait until this was here for me to get to. So, and I'm not saying you ought to all therefore become monks, or that is the goal. That is not. The first goal is the renunciation, the willingness to look and not just take over the values of your society, take over the values of your culture, take over the values of your parents, take over the values of your times, and say, this is the way I live. This is the way I must live, because that's what my society tells me. And it is not to turn on the society and attack it, or to reject it. It's to let go. And this comes to a key term in Buddhism, which is upeksha. And it has two meanings we're going to look at. The first is the idea of renouncing, of leaving behind, of abandoning, letting go of things. Yes, in the film, the person let go of his library. He gave his library away. That was a responsible act, just as we ask our monks and our lay people, be sure to make out a will. I know you're only 18 or 22 or whatever, or three. But it doesn't. Whatever your age is, it is good to take responsibility for your life, and therefore make out a will. Also, make out a thing of death wishes on things. You know, don't just dump your body on anybody that you happen to die on. Do something, figure out what you want done with it. And the thing is, this may take sitting with, if I figure out what you want to have done with your body. There are things like autopsies, cremation, burial, embalming, organ donor, any of these things. You know, And saying within the law, no, within what the law allows, because it varies from state to state and from situation to situation. And sometimes one has control over those things, sometimes there's not. But you put the wishes and say, I do not wish to be embalmed. I do not wish an autopsy under, you know, if it is at all possible, no autopsy, no embalming, and burial. Reverend Master. That's what she wanted. No embalming. She didn't get embalmed. No autopsy. The medical doctor said, no, she didn't want it, she didn't have to have it. And burial rather than cremation. Many, many Buddhists have cremation. Of course, in Tibet, they don't have cremation and they don't have burial. They take the body out and they chop it up and they feed it to the wild animals so that it is recycled. That's how they do it. Some say, oh, that's so grisly. Well, the animals who are fed by it don't feel it's grisly at all. They're grateful for that. And if you had to go to Tibet and dig a grave in Tibet, it's even worse than here. You know, anybody who objects, let them go. Anyway, so the thing is, it's taking responsibility in that way, and looking at what you are doing, so that you are, when you are abandoning your values, that you are also not just giving up and dumping your responsibilities on somebody else. In this world of values, like in the man in the film, he had a prized library. Now, there is nothing wrong with a scholar having a library. And there is nothing that says that the scholar must abandon the library. Where the problem arises is when the scholar goes beyond using the library because it is a convenient or necessary part of his work and says, I've got the best library on this subject in the world. Nobody's got the books that I got, and I'm so glad to show it to all my colleagues what I got. There's where the problem is. And that, of course, breaks a precept, because it puts yourself up and it puts somebody else down. Don't you wish you had what I had? Ooh, kind of thing. And that's where the problem lies. And that's part of what you're doing with renunciation. You're giving up, putting those value judgments on things which then stir up karmic feelings. Create karma. Now, that doesn't mean that a book you pay $150 for a book, or you pay 10 cents for a book that you get in a secondhand bookstore or something. You may feel, well, I better take care of this book because I put $150 in. There's no problem on the thing. It's just taking care. So it isn't just a question of, oh, no, all my books are equally equal, and everything's equally equal, and oh, everything's wonderful, you know. This kind of thing, it isn't that kind of attitude that we're talking here. It's this putting of values and saying, I'm famous, I'm more famous, I'm not famous enough, and getting caught up in fame and gain, and being praised, and then feeling depressed because you're not praised. Any of these things, this is all part of what the world is about, the ways of the world. And it's trying to extricate yourself from that, to pull yourself free from any of those things, and just look at things and see them, what they are, as they are. And that is what comes into the part of the renunciation is all acceptance. It's accepting everything as it is. It's not that it is not light and love and saying, oh, I hug everything I see. It's not that. It is an accepting of things being there, what they are. One uses them, one doesn't use them. One needs them, one doesn't need them, fine. If the person doesn't need the library anymore, he doesn't go out and burn it. What did he do? He passed it on to somebody else who could make use of it. And for me, as a person who was a scholar before I came in, it meant to become a monk meant giving up my library. And it was one of the happiest days in my life. Because I had lugged that library, all those thousands of books, halfway around the world and then back again, as well as all over the United States, packing and unpacking. It took me 2 months, literally 2 months, working all day long to pack the library. Because my library was that large. It was enormous. And of course, at various times when I had to send it, there would be driblets of that and drablets of that that get lost, you know, on the process. So my library would do sort of expand and contract and expand. But there was always a good solid hunk of books there that I had lugged around. And I had started lugging them when I was an adolescent. And I'd lugged them for decades and decades until finally I could get rid of the thing, I thought. But of course, the thing was, when I became a monk, I won't say I made the mistake, because it wasn't a mistake. I gave the library to the abbey. I thought, well, you know, you want books, I'll give you some books, you know, you don't need a library. You may find some of these useful, because there were Buddhist things, there were Far Eastern things, and that might be of interest, and feeling, well, what they didn't want, they could move on and sell and so forth. And I said, well, you know, I've got all these, bring them all down, and they'll take care of them. I said, fine, goodbye, books, goodbye. Of course, those who have seen my room know that it is filled with books again. But that's the thing, is that's part of my karma on the thing, apparently. But at least I don't have to possess them, I don't have to own them. And I don't have to pack them up anymore on the thing. And there are books which are what they should be. Books that I use because they are useful. They're helpful to me in one way or the other. And therefore I can make use of them. But it is, as far as holding on to them, as far as possessing them, and all that that implies, that's the renunciation. It's renouncing that aspect. It's letting go of that. It's abandoning my entanglement with the library. Now, those of you who are familiar with the Sharingana talks about entanglements, has several things to say about entanglements. Mm-hmm. Very important to look at those entanglements. When you go through the ceremony, if you do that, look at all the things it mentions that you can get entangled with, and they are all kinds of things you will find very much in the world. And they're the very things that we get entangled with, that we can get distracted by, that we can be pulled off our training. Therefore, to look at them and see what it is, where am I, where are you entangled still? And it's not saying you have to abandon anything. What you're trying to do is find out where you're entangled and disentangle yourself from it. Buddhism is not asceticism. It is not giving up and trying to live on 3 blades of grass a day. It's not Buddhism. Or plus 4 grains of rice to go mixed diet. So what upeksha on one level means is this whole idea of looking at yourself and looking at what you're attached to. And by attached, it does not mean, well, I'm attached to ice cream because I'm attached to chocolate ice cream because I like chocolate ice cream. I don't like vanilla ice cream. That's not what's meant by attachment. Attachment is something much stronger. It's, I can't live without this, and I don't mean air, but this is something I can't handle life if I don't have whatever. The latest, every year I've got to have a new car. I mean, I've got to. I can't live this life if I don't have a new car this year. And it's better if I can have next year's model than this year's model. But I've got to have it. I need it. And I remember something my wife said, that she had, and you can see this operating, that she once was in a supermarket. And there was this little boy, she said, must have been around 5 years old or something. And he was running after his mother, yelling and screaming, "I want royal chocolate pudding dessert! I want royal chocolate pudding dessert! I want royal chocolate pudding dessert!" You know, and you knew where he picked that up. You know, "Tell your mommy." Said, you know, so he was telling his mommy, and she said, turned to him, she said, "What do you want it for in the first place?" And he said, "I need it in my business." Now, where he picked that one up, I don't know. But it was that kind of surprise. Oh, my goodness, I need this in my business. I need this. I can't live. I'm not allowed to function in the universe if I don't have royal chocolate pudding dessert. And yet, one can laugh at that, but of course, one's own attachments is another matter. Right. Those we need. But it's looking at those things. And seeing what they are, being willing to say, okay, maybe I can do something about them. Maybe, if nothing else, maybe I can't give them up. But I can look at them, and perhaps I can see where they may be causing suffering within me. Are suffering to other people. How I'm putting myself through the ringer because of some kind of an attachment. And see if I can find some way. Then you may be able to say, well, gee, maybe I don't need this. And it gets it out of the area of I want or I don't want. It gets it out of the area of greed. Because greed is very, very difficult to get for anyone who has any greed, and that's everyone, of some sort. It's very hard to give up one's greed. They're not that serious a problem necessarily, but they are hard to get rid of. But you can begin to do it by looking at the way in which it is creating suffering. And then slowly you may be able to minimize it. So you say, well, this time, no, I'm going to pass it up. Not because I'm good and virtuous, but because I know if I eat that fourth piece of pie, I will have an effect from it. The third's okay, but the fourth, I know. You know. And that's where you begin on it, for letting up. And there need to be no guilt. Guilt reinforces it. And if you have feelings of guilt, then don't have feelings of guilt over having feelings of guilt. But unless you've got the guilt karma, and then you can find multiple levels to the self-torture on this. Okay. But then that's only a greed for guilt. That's a form of greed. I can indulge myself, wallow in a whipped cream world of guilt, just abandon myself to it on the thing. And it's not that kind of. Now that's talking of one aspect of upeksha. The other meaning of it is equanimity. And this comes out, the translations I've seen of upeksha with this is stoicism. I'll not complain though racked with pain, as the Schumann song goes. It's looked at as some kind of everything tastes like a vanilla wafer. All life must be just one bland flavor. And that's equanimity. When it isn't. What it is, especially, is that it is the other side of renunciation. It is what happens when you allow yourself to let go of things. You get to a point where you can accept whatever comes because you have gotten to a point where you're no longer afraid of things being what they are. Because there's a fear that's underlying. What if things are going to harm me? What if things are going to frighten me? What if I can't handle life? What if I can't handle this situation? And so there's that kind of a fear that's in there. And if I accept all things, I don't have to accept things I can't stand on things. But that's not what all acceptance is. All acceptance is saying this snake is a cobra. I will not therefore pat it on the head. I will keep away from it. because cobras have a habit of doing something to, when they get worked up, is to strike out and bite. And if they bite me, they will put a venom in me and I will die. But it's not going over and kissing the cobra on the forehead to show all acceptance. You accept the cobra for being a cobra. You accept the poison ivy for being what it is. And you don't go over and wallow in it. You just accept it for being what it is. That's all acceptance. And of course, the other side of that is non-attachment. And not holding on to anything. I say, oh, I've got to hold on to this, because this will protect me, or this will hold me, or this will keep me. So letting go. Not pushing anything away, and not holding on to anything. And this is all part of renunciation. It's learning how to put renunciation into your life, which is something you can do on an everyday basis. Because I am sure none of you lives such a totally sheltered life where you live inside a cardboard box and don't come out, that you do come into contact with things other than the inside of a cardboard box. And therefore you will come and meet situations which may be pleasant, which may be unpleasant. And you just accept them as being unpleasant. Yeah, this is the pits. Hello, pits, I've seen you before. Go on, and not worry. Letting go, abandoning one's fears. And not being afraid because of the word abandonment, which is a meaning that comes with upeksha. What I'm doing is abandoning something and leaving something unresolved behind, or my responsibilities. It is taking responsibility for your own life. It's not dumping it off onto somebody else. It's taking the responsibility for everything you do. And this is not an unpleasant experience when you do it. It doesn't have to be an unpleasant thing. It is letting go of an awful lot of stuff you've been lugging around. I lugged my library. What are you lugging around? Every one of you here is also lugging things around. Childhood griefs, childhood pains. What my sister did to me when I was 3. Whatever. It is holding on to the grief, holding on to the pain. And boy, try and get that out from that fist that's tight, holding on to the pains of childhood. And I'm sure there is no one here who has not had somewhere between the age of 0 and the age of 20 something that pained them. I mean, I just can't believe that anybody could get to 20, maybe to 19, but not to 20, and not have something happen that they found. I'm sure even the Buddha stubbed his toe once during his life and said, ouch. I can't believe he was totally free from all pain. But there's something. There will be something there that you're holding on to, that needs to be let go. Bow in gratitude to it. Send it merit, and then send it on its way. And when you begin to do this, and you're letting go of things, and letting go of these things, it isn't that you feel elated, is that you feel light. Things disappear. And you suddenly just wake up one morning and realize, I haven't thought about that kind of thing, or I haven't been bothered by that kind of thing now for a long time, and I'm not bothered by none, and it's gone. But it's the willingness to let go, the willingness not to hold on to old griefs. And sometimes it's not easy to. Because the griefs will be very, very insistent at times. But then you just sit with them and see what they need. Ask your griefs what they need. Just one more chance to hit my baby sister. That's what I need. And yet one has been hitting one's baby sister day in and day out, year in and year out, over and over, and it has never stopped. Until one says, finally, I think I'll start doing it. I've done it enough.